All right. We're going to get started with today's training. I'm going to cover some housekeeping rules first. Just so everybody knows, this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clueen for those not able to join us. The Clueen training page that brought you here today also has the slides available for download under download training materials in case you would like to refer to them at a later time or flip through them at your own pace during today's training. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical difficulties during any point during the training today. We'll have question and answer break at the end of the training. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they're going to be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training. The feedback form is located on the Clueen training page that brought you here today, and we will also be putting a link in the chat for everybody at the end to be able to find that easily. So with that, I'd like to introduce our training today, 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, understanding and mitigating the emerging global contaminants. This training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, the Australasian Land and Groundwater Association, and Nicole as well. And it is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. On slide four, I have the pleasure of introducing our facilitators today. Our facilitators are Charles Reyes, the director of ITRC, and Matt Potter, the CEO of ALGA. They're going to lead us through our different sections and orient us on the organizations as well. And with that, I'd like to introduce our expert trainers here today. They are joining us from ITRC, ALGA, and Nicole. And they're volunteering to be here today. And so we want to just take a moment and appreciate the time commitment and being here and to support this training. If you are interested in learning more about our facilitators or any of the trainers' backgrounds, we encourage you to look at those on the Clueen training page that also brought you here. But there's lots of good information on that page, so be sure to check it out after the training. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to ITRC Director Charles Reyes to just get us oriented on ITRC as an organization.
Great. Thank you, Devin. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for joining us tonight. As those on the US, I know it's a late evening if you're on the East Coast, and all around the world, we've got folks joining us, some probably in the middle of the night. So we appreciate your interest in this. As Devin said, I'm Charles Reyes. I'm the current director at ITRC. I'd like to welcome everybody for today's webinar on 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. I'm happy to provide this brief introduction on behalf of ITRC to share a little bit about what we do before we begin. I'd also like to thank our friends at ALGA and Nicole, who you're going to be hearing from soon, for joining us, and our entire ITRC 6-PPD team, led by Kelly and Tanya, for helping us put together this event. A little bit about ITRC. We are a program of the Environmental Research Institute of States, or ERIS, in the United States, which is an educational and research nonprofit corporation. We are a state government-led coalition that was established almost 30 years ago in 1995, led by a board of advisors that includes voting members from U.S. state government, environmental agencies, and non-voting members from U.S. federal government departments, and also industry partners. Our board of advisors and ITRC staff oversee several programs, including technical and training teams, outreach and engagement programs, various stakeholders, and special projects such as our Early Career Professionals, which has just celebrated its one-year anniversary. A summary of our memberships here on your screen. While we are a state-led association, like I mentioned before, we do have a diverse membership, which includes the state agencies, federal government agencies, tribal government representatives, private stakeholders and companies, academia, and even community stakeholders. In recent years, we've made a very proactive effort to expand membership to the international community, and today's one example of that success. As you can see on your screen, currently we have over 1,100 active members on our current project teams. But we do have interest in members from several thousand members across the US and the world. A summary is provided there in the table with exact numbers and also on the pie chart. And if you'd like to learn more information about becoming an ITRC member, I've included three links there to the right. We have a general membership page, provides more information about our various programs and more information about our industry affiliates program, which is our industry representatives from companies. That's both US and international. And then also, I mentioned earlier, our Early Career Professionals Program, and that's a group that assists new members to the environmental community in ITRC. So the slide here shows our current project teams, along with some references of where you can find more information. Our project teams are the main mechanism through which we achieve ITRC's purpose and mission. They help us produce guidance documents, tools, resources, training courses. And the links on the right provide examples of our current project teams. That's the top right. The one in the middle includes our new project teams that'll get kickstarted in January 2024. We are still looking for state team leaders. We've got about 2 days left. So if that's something of interest, be sure to check that out. Registration will open at the end of this year. And you can also find a list of our completed projects on the bottom right. And finally, after our project teams complete their guidance, we always transition over to a training phase to help disseminate information and research provided under those products. Through a partnership with EPA and CLUIN, like the one we're on today, we host many virtual trainings and workshops throughout the year. Upcoming virtual trainings you can provide on that, that link there on our calendar. You can also visit EPA's CLUIN webpage to find links to upcoming trainings. And again, we partner with other ITRC members and groups such as ALGA and NICOLE to provide training in person as well. We do have a group going to ALGA next month, so we're excited for that partnership to continue. And if you want to learn more, you can find archive training materials on that link as well. So I'm going to turn it over now to our friend Matthew Potter, the CEO of ALGA. Matt?
Thanks, Charles. As Charles noted, my name's Matt Potter, and I've been the CEO of ALGA since June 2022. So on behalf of ALGA, I'd also like to welcome you to today's webinar on 6PPD and 6PPD quinone. And I'm speaking to you from Melbourne, Australia. I would also like to thank our speakers for their insights and time today, and certainly to ITRC and NICOLE for their continued collaboration in events like these for the advancement of the contaminated land and groundwater industry. Just looking through. So just a brief snapshot on ALGA. So ALGA was established 16 years ago and provides a vehicle for information sharing and professional development across Australia and New Zealand's contaminated land and groundwater industry. And as you'll see from the next couple of slides, ALGA has a touch point across most facets of the industry. From a governance perspective, ALGA comprises currently 7 board directors. However, through each cycle, this can increase to up to 9 board directors. And for those ALGA members, I would encourage you that haven't nominated put their nominations in for the directors this year, I'd encourage you to do so, as we will be announcing our next round of directors at our Eco Forum conference next month. We have 16 branches or chapters, as they might be known, and 10 specialist interest groups. So rather than just talk about ALGA in isolation, I thought it would be good to share a couple of slides in relation to some of the similarities and differences between ALGA, ITRC and NICOLE. And Charles already has had a touch point on a slide in terms of the composition of ITRC. And what you can see here is also the composition of NICOLE as well. Just noting that these figures are probably about 5 months old, and I shared these at the PFAS symposium back in May of this year. So ALGA currently comprises around 3,100 members and has 94 corporate partners. Its rough split is around 30% individual members and around 70% corporate partners. You saw the figures that were presented there from Charles earlier in regards to around 1,164 individual members covering 119 corporate partners. Interesting to note that, you know, of those 119 corporate partners, there's around 30 that also overlap between ALGA and ITRC, showing certainly the commonality between those organisations. And I haven't done that comparison with Nicole yet. From an ALGA perspective, consultants still comprise the bulk of ALGA's members. However, that mix is changing, and we're pleased to see, particularly over the last 12 to 18 months, an uptake in regulator and academic membership, and we'll continue to push for diversification across our membership base. For ITRC, there's no relationship between the funding source and their membership. As was noted by Charles, as a state-led association, ITRC have an internal goal that 50% of their active members are from the states. Well, you can see from Nicole, there's pretty even split between sort of the consultant, property liability owner, and academics. From a specialist interest group perspective, as was noted in a couple of slides earlier, ALGA comprises 10 specialist interest groups or working groups across the three associations, and this may not include the latest updates that Charles has provided. So there are 16 specialist interest groups, five of which intersect between ALGA, ITRC, and Nicole. This year, ALGA was also pleased to launch the Early Career Professional Specialist Interest Group. And this group has been a fantastic addition to ALGA's portfolio. And we look forward to showcasing them at our Ego Forum event next month. For Nicole, as Sophie will confirm over the next couple of slides, so Nicole would normally only have 3 to 4 active working groups operating at any one time. And probably the other key difference just to note between ALGA, ITRC and Nicole is that ALGA and ITRC do have staff employed to facilitate and oversee the associations, where Nicole continues to be purely managed on a voluntary basis. If you'd like to know more about ALGA, then please jump onto our website. I'd also encourage you just to follow us on LinkedIn. We've got a whole heap of events coming up, both from a global perspective, but also from a local perspective. I'll then hand over to Sophie. Sophie will represent Nicole today, but Sophie Klass from ERM. Thank you, Sophie.
Yes, thank you, Matt, for so nicely comparing the associations. I will do a little bit of add-on on Nicole. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. I'm Sophie Klass from ERM, consulting director at ERM, Global Sustainable Consulting Company, and I'm representing here Nicole today. I'm dialing in from Belgium. So very briefly, as an add-on to what Matt was sharing, who is Nicole, leading European network that develops and shares state-of-the-art solutions for impaired land and related environmental concerns. As Matt mentioned, it's a network, an industry-led network, combining industry service providers and academics, and it focuses really on both liability management and value creation. So that's in a nutshell something to add on Nicole. And I'm now happy to actually start the webinar and the content part and introducing you to Tanya Williams of the Washington State Department of Ecology. So over to you, Tanya.
Great. Thank you, Sophie. And thank you all for joining us today. I am Tanya Williams, a 6PPD lead agency planner for the Washington State Department of Ecology. To begin our 6PPD and 6PPD quinone webinar, I'm going to walk you through the discovery of this chemical and what work is being done to find a solution to this problem. So first, let's talk about tire wear particles. Tire wear particles are emitted from every car driven on our roads. Some particles travel longer distances and some settle on and near the road. These roadway particles accumulate until something picks them up or washes them off the road, like rain. Many road systems are designed to convey the rain to lakes, streams, and rivers. And many road systems are in what we like to call stormwater. If a system isn't in place to filter or remove the tire wear particles, these particles are also conveyed to surface water. If the rain falls on a road that hasn't been rained on for weeks or months, the concentration of these tire wear particles will be much higher. This is creating a critical problem for areas that have high traffic roadways that intersect with lakes, streams, or rivers. Now, this rain is necessary for the functioning of the ecosystems that depend on it, including the aquatic environment that we are going to focus on here today. However, the tire wear particles that are picked up by the rain contain many chemicals. These chemicals, and notably one chemical in particular, is causing dangerous disruptions to critical ecosystem species. Now, this timeline in front of you documents key observations and research related to coho salmon, one of five of the Pacific salmon species that can live in freshwater and saltwater, also known as anadromous, and the path to get to our understanding of 6PPD quinone's impacts. As early as the 1980s, researchers documented observations of coho salmon mortality. Documentation in 1990 indicated that something in stormwater was toxic to coho salmon and discussed observations of mortality occurring after rain events in urban streams. Between 1990 and 2011, a period of over 20 years, riparian restoration efforts were working to improve salmon habitat in the hopes of reversing the trend of increased mortality. However, during routine monitoring of the restored salmon habitat, coho mortality was still being observed. In 2011, Nat Schultz and his colleagues published a paper documenting urban runoff mortality syndrome, or pre-spawn mortality, in Puget Sound streams in Washington state. The 2011 paper documented a multi-year effort to observe creeks in the Puget Sound watershed with the goal of quantifying cases of pre-spawn mortality. Up to 100% of coho salmon died before they could spawn in the urban creeks. In female carcasses, there was a greater than 90% egg retention. Observed symptoms in the salmon that were seen alive included disorientation, swimming on their side, and gasping. Road runoff or stormwater was hypothesized as the cause. Courtesy of Puget Sound Keeper here in Washington State, I want to show you this one-minute video documenting acute symptoms that appear as respiratory distress and include gasping at the water surface, fin swaying, and loss of equilibrium. A lot of research began on stormwater to determine how to prevent the mortality and the symptoms that you just saw in the video from occurring and to better understand what in the stormwater was causing it. In 2016, a team of researchers led by Jewel Ann Spromberg determined that bioretention soil media, which is a mix of sand and compost, prevented this pre-spawn mortality. And then in 2018, Jen McIntyre and colleagues documented that chum salmon are found to be more tolerant than coho. which showed us that there is variability in response among specific salmon to the stormwater toxicity. And during this time, researchers had also been suspecting tyra particles in stormwater as the primary cause of pre-spawn mortality, which led them to start looking for specific chemicals or a chemical. A team of researchers at the University of Washington, Tacoma, Center for Urban Waters, and Washington State University's Washington Stormwater Center started using high-resolution mass spectrometry in 2018 to try to identify the chemicals contained within tire wear particle leachate. Over 2,000 chemicals were identified, and then through a series of numerous chemical fractionation processes and approximately 3 years of work, the researchers discovered a 6 ppd quinone. Zhenyu Tian and colleagues documented this discovery of 6 ppd quinone in 2020, indicating that it did in fact induce acute mortality in coho salmon. This discovery was groundbreaking and led to an all hands on deck approach to prevent 6 ppd quinone from coming in contact with coho salmon. So what is 6 ppd quinone and where does it come from? 6 ppd is used as an antioxidant and antioxidant in tires to prevent cracking and increase longevity in tires. Manufacturers started using 6 ppd in tires in the 1960s and are estimated to have started using it in all tires in the early 1970s. 6 ppd is directly responsible for tires meeting some of the tire performance regulations. Although there are other chemicals that can serve the same function as 6 ppd, it is assumed to be present in some percentage in all tires due to the superior functionality of this chemical in comparison to other chemicals. 6 ppd easily moves through the rubber matrix of the tire during dynamic flexing and operation, allowing continuous binding of 6 ppd with ozone, thus providing continuous protection from cracking. However, when 6 ppd reacts with ozone, it produces 6 ppd quinone. 6 ppd has also been found in other sources made out of recycled tires like crumb rubber for turf field and playgrounds, rubber mulch for gardens, and rubber floor mats. We will talk about what we know about 6 ppd quinone toxicity a little bit later in the webinar. This conceptual exposure model was developed to create a visual of the potential routes of transport through environmental media and the organisms that could potentially be impacted. 6 ppd in tires is converted to 6 ppd quinone when exposed to ozone. 6 ppd quinone is contained in tire wear particles that can be transported in the air and potentially inhaled by people. The particles can also be deposited on surfaces, soils, and plants, including foods, leading to potential plant uptake and human dermal exposure and ingestion. Tire wear particles can also stay near the roadway and be transported to surface waters through stormwater drains and runoff. 6 ppd quinone in surface waters can be ingested and absorbed by fishes. Exposed organisms can be ingested by humans and other species. 6 ppd quinone can potentially be mitigated by green stormwater infrastructure. Research is ongoing to further define 6 ppd quinone's environmental behaviors, exposures, and the potential development of adverse health outcomes. One of the challenges is finding 6 ppd quinone to evaluate and verify areas where vulnerable aquatic species are being lethally impacted. The geographic scope of the tire and road contaminant problem is extensive, as you can see in this map. It estimating potentially vulnerable areas in Washington state based on traffic, land cover, and salmon distribution. 6 ppd quinone concentrations can vary widely due to environmental, chemical, and infrastructure factors. Because sampling can't be completed in every potential area, mapping tools are being developed to estimate high impact areas to focus sampling efforts and also to confirm presence of 6 ppd quinone based on several indicators. Some of the indicators that are being looked at that can affect vulnerability include how much traffic and impervious surfaces in the area, other environmental factors that would impact the rate that 6 ppd transforms to 6 ppd quinone, the transport of the 6 ppd quinone from the road to the streams, dilution within that stream, and then how long the 6 ppd quinone stays in the stream. And also tire wear particulate loadings in streams that could be a continual source of 6-PPD quinone. And that's a continual source of contamination to the watershed. Well, researchers work to find 6-PPD quinone in the environment and further characterize the bait and transport. Work is also being done to determine the best technologies to remove it from stormwater so that it doesn't reach surface waters. There are several types of stormwater best management practices, or BMPs, that are projected to have a high probability of mitigating 6-PPD quinone. Source control BMPs are practices that prevent stormwater contaminants from entering storm drain systems. These practices prevent 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone from entering stormwater in the first place. Source control BMPs include street sweeping and cleaning roadside ditches, catch basins, and storm pipes. Flow control BMPs slow the runoff and reduce runoff volume through the on-site management of water. This is in contrast to the design of many older roadways where stormwater is flushed off the road and into the waterway quickly. Flow control BMPs include bioretention swales, infiltration basins, detention ponds, and permeable pavement. And lastly, runoff treatment BMPs reduce concentrations of targeted pollutants through filtration and chemical sorption. To date, bioretention soil mixes are one of the most effective methods of reducing 6-PPD quinone exposure and thus mortality to coho salmon. Currently, stormwater best management practice researchers are working to optimize many of these technologies to develop the most efficient and long-lasting BMPs and maximize 6-PPD quinone and tire wear particulate removal. Current research projects include longevity and effectiveness of the bioretention media to remove 6-PPD quinone, and another is efficiency and frequency of street sweeping. Compost amended bioswales are a stormwater BMP that controls both the flow of the stormwater and also it's a runoff treatment through a layering of topsoil, compost, and grass. Results of a study conducted by McIntyre and colleagues at Washington State University represented an accelerated timeline of 10 water years by passing water that was contaminated with 6-PPD quinone through the lab-managed bioretention soil mix, showing prevention of coho mortality over the 18-month study period, which is very promising for compost-amended biosoils. To provide a long-term solution to this highly aquatic toxic chemical, work is also being done to identify alternatives to 6-PPD in tires that can ultimately reduce or eliminate 6-PPD quinone in the environment. The Washington State Department of Ecology issued a hazard assessment in November of 2021, indicating that there are existing antidegradants that could potentially replace 6-PPD in tires. The parent chemical toxicity is extremely important to classify, which is what the hazard assessment was looking at. As if it is acutely toxic itself, then it would not be a good substitute for 6-PPD. The results showed, as you can see in the table, that four of the chemicals had safer scores than 6-PPD. The extent of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone impacts on vulnerable populations and overburdened communities will be determined as knowledge advances. One to note are communities near roadways and being disproportionately comprised of lower income people and people of color, making the potential impacts of airborne 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone on those communities a notable environmental justice concern. And lastly, I want to touch briefly on tribal government considerations, salmonid mortality, which can be caused by 6-PPD quinone, but also other toxic chemicals, climate change, habitat loss, and additional factors, disproportionately impacts tribal nations in North America by threatening tribal treaty rights, access to traditional foods, and cultural and economic well-being of Indigenous peoples. So I know that was a surface brush of a lot of information on 6-PPD. I encourage you to reach out to me anytime for more information or resources. And I thank you for the opportunity. And I want to introduce you next to Bob Simons of Eurofins, and he is going to discuss sampling and analysis with you. So, Bob.
Daniel, thanks very much. That was a great introduction. I wanted to start by congratulating the guys at the University of Washington. They've done an outstanding job of prioritizing this contaminant, and it's a lot of hard work. There was a recent paper that they put out, and I just wanted to stress the importance of running commercial standards here. What they assessed when they got a standard that was metrologically traceable, they determined that the toxicity was about 8 times lower than what they'd originally figured. So what they've done, and this is the work, and I've just taken this directly from their paper, but the 6-PPD quinone, the LC50 is, as you can see there, is 0.1 or 95 nanograms per liter. So, you know, very, very low. So it provides a challenge for us as analytical chemists to analyze this compound at these trace levels. So I'm going to take you through the journey that we've done. And it's been in conjunction with our colleagues in the US. Andrew Patterson at our West Sacramento lab has been very helpful in guiding us down this track. So on the sampling side of things, what we recommend here is the minimum sample sizes for waters and solids. And we've done, you know, wastewater or runoff from roads. We've also done some saline water and solids like sediments and tire crumb. But it's important that we use amber glass bottles because of issues with photodegradation. So we're saying that at the moment the holding times are not fully delineated. So we're trying to keep them as short as possible to 7 working days. Sorry, 7 days. One of the things I want to highlight here was the importance of using glass. As you can see, this is a paper by Hugh et al. That was published earlier this year, and they went through the different types of tubes and so forth in the analytical thing, and worked out what the extraction efficiency was. And as you can see, glass here is pretty much a quantitative extraction, but when you get into rubber and so forth, you get a lot less recovery. So it's important that, you know, when you're doing your analytical workup, that you're using the right equipment. One of the other challenges is the solubility of the 6-PPD and the quinone, and I'll go into that on the next slide, but basically, it's quite low solubility, and there's a lot of variability in the reported solubility figures, and that's primarily because the 6-PPD does go off quite rapidly in the environment. So I'm not going to go through all of these figures, but I just wanted to highlight you know, some of the issues here with the water solubility. So the 6-PPD quinone, it ranges from, you know, 51 milligrams per liter down to about, certainly a lot less than that. But also the low KOW and the organic content as well. Half-life, as you'd expect, is quite low. And that's why, you know, the holding time with conservatively set at 7 days. So just a little bit about the analytical work that we do. To get down to those parts per trillion levels, we need to do a concentration step. And this is just a figure of the solid phase extraction system that we use. We use an isotope dilution. So we're adding a isotopically labeled 6-PPD quinone standard at the beginning. And we take that through the concentration and also the quantification step. So this is an effort to get down to that limit of reporting in the low parts per trillion levels. We're using a targeted technique here. Tanya mentioned the high resolution mass spectrometry, and I'll get to that in a second, but we use a targeted technique here, and we've expanded also our method to cover some other tire degradants, which I'll get to shortly. So I just wanted to acknowledge the work that the state of Washington have done. They've produced their own SOP on the extraction and analysis of 6-PPD quinone. And the method that we've developed in conjunction with our colleagues in the US pretty much mimics this standard, which is good. And we understand that the US EPA is close to publishing their own method. But the state of Washington's Department of Ecology method is basically a targeted technique using isotope dilution, LCMS-NS. The method that we use also incorporates, as well as the 6-PPD quinone, it also incorporates a couple of other tire degradants, the 1,3-diphenylguanidine and HMMM, the hexamethylmethoxymelamine, that are also used as additives to tires. And I think Lakesh is going to talk about that shortly, some results. The reporting levels that we look at, as I said, the toxicity of the 6-PPD quinone for the coho salmon is 95 nanograms per litre. We're sitting at about 0.1 nanogram per litre, or 0.3031 ppb, micrograms per litre. The HMMM and the 1,3 DPG are a little bit less sensitive, but we find them in quite high concentrations. For the solids, the sediment and tire crumb, you can see there the limits there in ppb. So again, we've tried to have the limits of reporting, or the reporting levels for 6-PPD quinone, as low as we can possibly go. So just want to touch on some high-resolution mass spectrometry work that has been done in our Brisbane laboratory. This is a quadrupole time-of-flight mass spectrometer, and this is a similar instrument that the guys at the University of Washington used to first detect the 6-PPD quinone. And basically, it gives you a much better way of looking at the different transformation products that are there. So this is the transformation of, or the ozonation of, the 6-PPD through the intermediate there, which is, and then goes to the quinone. And this transformation is was reported by Tian et al. In the paper in 2021. So this intermediate product here is this QI, 6-PPD QI, and this is what we have also found. It is not there for very long, so it's one of those ones that moves quite quickly to the quinone. This is the HMMM, so it's a very similar product to atrazine, and the toxicity hasn't really been delineated at this particular stage. And this is some work that was done by Stewart et al. And this just shows you the number of transformation products that you get from 6-PPD. So you've got the 6-PPD parent compound, then the QI, and then the 6-PPD quinone. But there's a whole range of other transformation products that we're looking at detecting using that high resolution mass spectrometry technique. And that's all from me, and I'd like to hand over to Lakesh.
Thank you, Bob. As Bob mentioned, I'm Lakesh Pandey. I'm an associate professor of environmental engineering at the University of Auckland. And my research group is mostly focused on understanding the occurrence and fate of emerging contaminants, including 6-PPD quinone, in natural and engineered systems. As engineers, we also research some of the innovative treatment technologies to remove these contaminants. And in my brief part today, I'm just going to touch on 6-PPD quinone in wastewater, which is not much discussed until now. So till now, the discussion on 6-PPD quinone has mostly been focused on stormwater, its analysis, and so on, and rightfully so, because as you know, 6-PPD quinone is associated with tar ware particles, so road runoff is a significant source. But what we wanted to find out is how important that source is in wastewater, what concentration of 6-PPD quinone exists in the influent and effluents, but also at different stages of wastewater. So what kind of treatment processes are more effective, are not effective, and so on. But another important angle why to study wastewater is because a lot of wastewater treatment plants around the world are combined sewers, as many of you are aware, and they discharge a large quantity of waters into our surface waters or coastal environments, and concentrations may be low, but the lures can be significantly higher. And that was highlighted by the paper that Bob mentioned towards the end of his slides, the Seward et al., the water research paper that came out last year. And they looked at 6-PPD quinone, but they also looked at some of the other transformation products. So what I would like you to take home from this table are two things. First is 6-PPD quinone is just a small part of the transformation products of 6-PPD. So there are a number of transformation products that Bob showed that form from 6-PPD reacts with ozone. And 6-PPD quinone, even though the concentrations appear lower in wastewater, what you are seeing is the load is significantly higher. So as you can see, the gram per day load is significantly higher because just the wastewater volume is so high. Also from their study, you will notice that the snow melt and rainfall, which are the wet weather events, generate a lot more 6-PPD quinone as you expect. So they found that 50 to 100 nanogram per liter in wastewater influent. And they did not find anything in the effluent, and they did not find anything 6-PPD quinone in the influent or effluent when it was a dry weather event. But I just want to note that the detection limit for their study was 25 nanogram per liter. And as Bob mentioned, with the new advanced analytical techniques, we can go up to 0.1 nanogram per liter. So we believe that non-detect is mostly because the detection limits were high. So we were keen to understand not only influent and effluent concentrations, but as I was mentioning, what happens at different stages of wastewater and what kind of treatment efficiencies we are going to observe for 6-PPD quinone. So we look at one of the largest treatment plants in New Zealand, which is well protected from stormwater runoffs in the sense that it has a very small portion, which has a combined sewer, but mostly the stormwater drains are very well separated from the wastewater network. And we looked at the concentrations at different stages of wastewater. What we found out is that 6-PPD quinone concentrations were an order of magnitude lower than that's been reported by 4 or 5 studies so far in the wastewater influent and effluent. Many of these studies report the concentration of 6-PPD quinone about 10 to 100 nanogram per liter. And what we found out is about a nanogram per liter. And the concentrations were not much different in different stages. One of the reasons being that the reactions of transformations are complicated. 6-PPD has a shorter half-life than 6-PPD quinone. So not only 6-PPD is coming in, but it's getting transformed to 6-PPD quinone during different stages as well. So it's very difficult to ascertain the treatment efficiencies just based on a couple of rounds of sampling that we have done. We did not only monitor 6-PPD quinone, we also monitored a couple of other tar-related chemicals like DPG and HMM that Bob showed. What I wanted to highlight from this slide is that we took one sample from a stormwater drain that supplies to the combined sewer. And as you can see, the concentrations of 6-PPD quinone was 40 times higher, which clearly indicates that may be the main source in the wastewater for 6-PPD quinone. But in terms of the removal efficiency, as I was saying, in terms of the wastewater, we did not observe much for 6-PPD quinone as well as for DPG. But for HMM, which is also another tar-related chemicals, we saw actually the increase in HMM concentrations as the water parcel passes through the different stages of wastewater treatment. And we believe that's primarily because different sources, there may be a different sources of HMM, but also there are precursors which are getting converted to HMM. So in summary, in terms of the 6-PPD quinone in Westwater, there are a lot less studies. There are 4 or 5 studies that have actually monitored the concentrations of 6-PPD quinone in the influent and effluent. To our knowledge, there is no study that has actually looked at different stages as we have done. And the concentrations, most of these studies are reporting are an order of magnitude lower than most of the concentrations reported in the literature for road runoffs, which is again an indication of road runoff being a significant source. And depending on how much source it's contributing to your wastewater, the concentrations can differ. Wet weather concentrations are higher, of course, because again, another implication, that another point that is implying that the 6-PPD is the main source coming from the road runoffs. And the treatment efficiencies are difficult to ascertain because of the complexities of the processes, as I mentioned earlier. So with that, I would like to hand it over to Dr. Kelly Grant from California Department of Toxic Substances.
Thanks, Lokesh. I already moved ahead. I just want to talk about ecotox and human health with specific regard to 6-PPDQ today. So as Tanya mentioned, 6-PPD quinone was initially discovered because of its toxicity to coho salmon. And coho salmon are still the most sensitive species that have been tested so far. They have an LC50, or the concentration that kills 50% of them, of just 0.08 micrograms per liter in just 24 hours. Now, as we go through this, you'll see that the LC50s vary greatly amongst different species. And I'd like you to keep in mind that the concentration, highest concentration that's been detected in surface water is 2.8 micrograms per liter. So the next two most sensitive species are from a completely different genus or group of salmon. So the salmonids are grouped into trout, char, Atlantic and Pacific salmon, as well as a couple other species. And these two both have a very low LC50, well below environmental detection concentrations. And they also have a quick onset of symptoms. Brook trout are native to North America, but have been introduced in Australia and Europe. So the next most sensitive species is rainbow trout, or its ocean-going form, steelhead. Now these have a much lower level of toxicity, and the symptoms take longer to manifest. So these rainbow trout are native to the northern Pacific Ocean, mostly in North America, but these have been broadly introduced really throughout the world. So Chinook salmon are the most closely, or Chinook, or also called king salmon, are most closely related to coho salmon. But if you notice, their LC50 is about 3 orders of magnitude higher than the coho. We did, out of an abundance of caution, give them this light green color because they have shown sensitivity to roadway runoff in a study by French et al. These other salmonids show no toxicity at environmentally relevant concentrations. In addition, no fish species outside of the salmonids have shown toxicity to 6-PPD quinone, and there's a growing list of invertebrates that are also quite tolerant of 6-PPD quinone. So how does 6-PPD quinone kill the coho so quickly? Well, there's a couple hypotheses of its mode of action. And the first one really involves the massive leakage of plasma from blood vessels and failure of the blood-brain barrier. So one of the first symptoms that was noticed of 6-PPD quinone or urban runoff mortality syndrome was this increased hematocrit. And that was really unexplained until Stephanie Blair did this really elegant experiment where she perfused fluorescent dye into the blood of coho salmon. She left some untreated as a control and treated others with roadway runoff. So in this control, you should be able to see a little residual fluorescence around the heart and the gills, but that fluorescent dye has stayed confined to the blood vessels. You'll notice that the brain, which you can sort of orient to here, shows no fluorescence. However, if we look at the coho treated with roadway runoff, you can see that there's just blazing fluorescence here in the brain. Now, normally the blood-brain barrier should work to keep molecules like this out of the brain. Now, neurons are not going to function properly if their chemical milieu has changed this dramatically. And this breach in the blood-brain barrier may also allow other neurotoxicants to enter the brain. This is supported by another recent paper by Justin Greer, who showed that genes important for blood vessel architecture have been dysregulated in coho treated with 6-PPD quinone. The other hypothesis about the mode of action was mitochondrial dysfunction. So Mahoney et al. Took an in vitro approach, and she treated rainbow trout, gill cells, and liver cells with 6-PPD quinone. The 6-PPD quinone killed the gill cells, but not the liver cells. The gill cells also showed an increased rate of oxygen consumption, which is consistent with mitochondrial dysfunction. They didn't see that in the liver cells. Interestingly, they did not see any evidence of biotransformation or what we might call metabolism in those gill cells, whereas they did in the liver cells. So this suggests that metabolism may play a role in this, and there's been a couple other papers that will probably be coming out quite soon that suggest that metabolism may play a role in either or in species sensitivity of 6-PPD quinone, as well as whether it may be activating or actually detoxifying 6-PPD quinone. So another recent paper came out by Justin Greer, where they exposed coho embryos episodically throughout development, mostly prior to hatching. And they got some really surprising results. The first was that about 17% of those treated with 0.9 micrograms per liter of 6-PPD quinone died, but 5 to 8 days post-exposure. So first thing you'll probably notice is this is about an order of magnitude greater than what kills older stage coho. So we know that these youngest stages of the coho are more tolerant. We don't know why yet, though. The other thing that's really interesting is this delayed mortality. We don't have a good indication of what is causing that. They did see these developmental effects where they saw a decreased growth in terms of both the area of the eye and the total length of the embryo. So I'm going to take a hard turn now and talk about human exposure. So if we go back to that conceptual model that Tanya showed earlier, we know that humans have a potential to be exposed. We haven't necessarily teased out what those dominant exposure pathways are, though. So in 2022, Do-It-All did a really interesting study where they detected 6-PPD quinone in human urine. Now, one of the most striking results was that pregnant women had higher levels of the chemical in their urine. And it's really unclear what might be driving that. It could be increased exposure or potentially differences in metabolism. That's another area of continued study. So in California, we tend to break hazard traits down into those related to exposure potential and those related to toxicity. So I want to keep that trend and focus on what we know about these 6-PPD quinones hazard traits. First, we know, or we don't know really, that much about bioaccumulation. There's really insufficient information. There have been some studies that have hinted at it, but the studies were really inadequate to draw any firm conclusions about bioaccumulation yet. Recent paper came out about 3 weeks ago that showed that in mouse that, sorry, in mice that were treated with 6-PPD quinone through oral gavage, were able to pass 6-PPD quinone through the placenta to the developing fetus. And in those fetuses, as well as adults, we saw that 6-PPD quinone can pass through the blood-brain barrier. So these indicate potential pathways of exposure that we need to continue to explore. In terms of toxicity, we still don't know a lot. And there have been some studies, and some of these would really benefit from replication. But we 6-PPD quinone is predicted to cause oxidative stress. And some liver toxicity has been demonstrated. So there was a dose-dependent increase in lipids and triglycerides in mice that were gavaged with 10 milligrams per kilogram per day. And above that dose as well for 6 weeks. And then lastly, I've just acknowledged that there are a lot of data gaps out there, but we have learned a lot. Keep in mind, 6-PPD quinone was only discovered in December 2020. So we have summarized what we do know in our focus sheet that is on the ITRC website. And because this is the science is emerging so rapidly, I'd urge you to stay tuned to our full guidance document. And with that, I will turn it over to Charles Reyes from ITRC.
Thank you all. And yeah, I'm just here for a quick transition. So next we're going to hear about what's going on across the world from the in the US, Europe, and Australia. And we'll start with Sophie in Europe.
Yes, I'm happy to give you a short current status of the European chemical legislation and the potential implication on 6-PPD use in products. So, where are we? So, chemical legislation fits into the overall EU framework, the European Green Deal. The European Green Deal is the EU strategy to a climate neutral, clean, and circular economy by 2050. It includes goals to improve protection of human health and the environment from hazardous chemicals and to move towards a toxic-free environment. And there are two key policies supporting this, chemical strategy for sustainability and the EU action plan towards zero pollution for air and water. And what it also states that only exploiting chemical benefits will be allowed if it can be demonstrated that there are no negative impacts on health and environment. So if we now look at chemicals, and chemicals are being classified in Europe according to an EU chemical classification system. How does that work? Very, very briefly, under the new regulations, EU chemicals will be assessed against different hazard classes for classification. And The first class is, for example, endocrine disruption, chemicals that may interfere with hormonal systems and thereby produce harmful effects. A second way of classifying is chemicals as persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. So those are substances that last a long time in the environment and accumulate in biota, having an adverse effect. And another classification is persistent, mobile, and toxic. Those are the substances that also last a long time in the environment and accumulate in water, having adverse effects. What if we now bring this to 6-PPD, where are we with the classification of 6-PPD? So the current state, registration databases indicates in Europe already that 6-PPD is toxic. However, since 6-PPD is not yet classified as persistent or mobile, this classification of toxic has no significant impact yet on the registration for manufacturers who use this 6-PPD in their products. So currently, 6-PPD in Europe is not yet a substance of very high concern, nor under significant EU scrutiny. What will be the future state, or what can happen in the future? 6-PPD and their transformation products need to be assessed against all those hazard classes. And the outcome could impact long-term use of 6-PPD in the products. If at some point in time 6-PPD were classified as persistent and mobile, this toxic classification will trigger identification of 6-PPD as a substance of very high concern. Same goes for endocrine disruption. It must be assessed today if chemicals are endocrine disruptors. If 6-PPD is such a chemical, this would also trigger that classification as a substance of very high concern. So in a summary, if 6-PPD is classified as persistent, mobile, toxic, or endocrine disruptive, 6-PPD will then be assessed for essential use with a view to eventually replace it and withdraw it from the market. This fits in a time frame. Member states are currently making proposals for a classification of all the chemicals, including 6-PPD. And the 1st of November 2026 is the mandatory date for those new classifications and labeling. And a classification of a substance in one of those hazard classes will result in a proposal as a substance of very high concern compound. And that will be then assessed for restriction from the market. So that's what the future is looking at. What else is playing a role in Europe? Very briefly, we see increase in detection of industrial chemicals in monitoring studies. There is significant regulatory focus on the monitoring of industrial chemicals in water resources. A lot of attention goes to emerging and new contaminants. Those are potentially very difficult to remove from water during treatment processes, potentially long-term effects on the health. What else do we see? Protection of water resources is identified as a major policy driver, and we see an overall focus to a transition to safe and sustainable by design in Europe. So that's in brief the status of the legislation in Europe, and I'm now happy to give the word to Bob to discuss briefly Australia legislation status.
Thanks, Sophie, and it's going to be brief. There's not much happening here in Australia. Our government, Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, operates the National Tyre Products Stewardship Scheme, and that is handed over to the Tyre Stewardship Australia, who manages the actual program. But the information that I can see is that roughly 500,000 tons of tyres each year are disposed of, and a significant majority ends up in landfill. So it's causing some grief. So we're pretty much on a watching brief to see, what happens in the US, and very interesting to hear what's happening in the EU as well. So I'll hand it over to Lakesh, who give an update on what's happening in across the ditch in New Zealand.
Yeah, so this is going to be very brief as well. I'm not a regulator. So I consulted a principal research scientist from New Zealand Environmental Protection Authority, Dr. Peter Dawson, and the information presented here is actually from him. So currently there are no guidelines or regulations on 6-PPD quinone or other tar-related chemicals, but Peter mentioned that it's listed on New Zealand inventory of chemicals, which is basically the chemicals that are monitored by the country in terms of their import and export, etc. It's not approved to be used under hazardous substances, which means it cannot be manufactured or imported into New Zealand by itself, but it can be part of the component of a product, which is the main challenge, as we know. It can be part of the tires, for example, that can be imported to the country. However, with the webinar, he mentioned that now, because of this webinar, 6-PPD quinone is on the radar of New Zealand EPA. So with that positive note, I will hand it over to Tania for regulation status in US.
Great, thank you, Lokesh. We are going to briefly look at a couple of the things happening in the United States. So first off, US EPA is actively developing a method for measuring 6-PPD quinone in surface water, and it's in the final stages. So we should see that later this fall. And in Washington State, we are continuing to do stormwater BMP research. We are developing an alternatives assessment for replacing 6-PPD in tires. We are developing an action plan that will look at all of the research and develop recommendations to our legislature on how to mitigate 6-PPD quinone and make changes within Washington State. And we've also proposed 6-PPD as a priority chemical within our Safer Products for Washington program. And then in California, which is where Kelly Grant works, they will begin regulating 6-PPD in motor vehicles through their Safer Consumer Products program on October 1st. So here in a couple of days. And tire manufacturers' initial screening of potential alternatives within that program are due to California on March 29th of 2024, if you want to track that process. And that is it for that. And I will pass it back to Charles.
Thank you, Tania, and to all of our speakers. That was a lot of information that we covered in just an hour. So we really appreciate that. I do want to note that some questions were asked in the Q&A panel that were answered by our guest. So you should be able to see the question and the answer. But if you do have some, continue to send them in. I will start with one that came in. I guess I'll pass it to Kelly. You just talked about Washington State and California on the West Coast. Is this only a problem on the West Coast in the United States?
I think it's going to be a problem much more broadly. I mean, certainly this is where we've seen the toxic effects of 6-PPD quinone. But if we look at the salmonids, they are spread broadly across generally cold weather regions. But for example, rainbow trout have been introduced worldwide. So I think it can be a problem worldwide. There's also the potential that it may be more than salmonids that are sensitive. And we still don't have a good understanding of those sublethal effects that it might have on fish. And we have seen some effects on fish that have do not show acute toxicity, but they have some sublethal effects, particularly in regards to development and behavior. So there is potential that it may be a much broader problem than just with coho salmon.
Thank you, Kelly. Matt, did you get any directed to you?
Thanks, Charles. Yeah, look, I've just got one here from for Bob. So Bob, a question just came through regarding recycling of tires. And have you had any experience in their use as an asphalt binder in making roads? And in particular, is there any data regarding the runoff from those particular asphalt roads?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Look, we haven't done anything directly ourselves, but there was a paper published in the last month or so where they were using recycled tyres as part of the road base, and they had found some detections of 6-PPD quinone and other transformation products from that road base. So yeah, it is potentially an issue, but we haven't done any work directly.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Bob. Charles, any further questions from your end?
I will go to one in the question box. I believe it's already been answered. That's the specific one about groundwater. I guess I'll open it up to anyone. Is 6-PPD a problem in groundwater? And do you know what the best remediation method is? Oh, it
Yeah,
looks like.
I can speak to that, Charles. Yes, we did. That's a great question, and I know somebody else had that earlier as well. It is a data gap and something we are following and trying to get more information on. So if anybody on this call has research that they know is occurring with groundwater and sampling, we would appreciate the information.
Fantastic. There was another question there just in the chat. Has anyone looked into tyre piles at monofills, illegal disposal piles impacting surface water? So I'm not sure if any of our panelists are in a position to answer that one.
I'll have a crack at that, Matt. We've done some work from a sports field, a synthetic sports field, where they've used tyre crumb in the fill, and we've found quite high levels of the 6-PPD quinone coming from that sports field.
Thanks for that, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. I've got one that kind of builds off of alternatives question that was just answered by Kelly. And maybe Tanya, you could help out too, or anyone in Europe and Australia. What work is being done to find an alternative chemical that could replace 6-PPD in tires specifically?
Yeah, we're funding quite a bit of research here in Washington. We are doing a lot of toxicity research, so looking at some of the identified alternatives that we've been working with tire manufacturers to determine whether they would be effective in tires and provide the same level of safety and protection as 6-PPD. And those ones that are potentials, we are running toxicity tests and looking at whether they are toxic to coho salmon and other sensitive species like rainbow trout. But then also looking at if you ozonate those parent chemicals, whether their transformation products are toxic as well. So we're doing a lot of toxicity research right now on those alternatives to try to figure out if there is a potential existing chemical that could easily replace 6-PPD. I know there are researchers around the world that are also looking at synthesizing new antiozonants that would potentially work better in tires than 6-PPD, but also be safer. So we're watching the science and trying to figure out which direction we would like to go.
Great. Well, we are almost at our mark, but Matt, did you have anything? And I know Devin was going to wrap us up as well to talk about the question and answers.
Yeah, look, just one more for Lakesh, particularly in regards to the recent studies undertaken out of New Zealand. And I suppose the question is, based on the wastewater data that has been collected, is it safe to assume that wastewater treatments are ineffective in removing 6-PPD?
Yeah, so that's a significant research gap there. As mentioned, what we did was a couple of rounds of sampling, and what I was mentioning is a couple of rounds of samplings are not enough. even though those were composite samples, and we even if we take into account the parcel transit times and so on, because there are transformation reactions that are happening, there is also partitioning that's happening with both 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. And yeah, it's very difficult to say what are the certain, to ascertain the definite treatment efficiencies of the processes. But that's the gap we are working on in terms of understanding more prolonged sampling, as well as some of the lab scale studies.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Prakash. Look, I think that's it from me, Charles. If there's anything else from your end at all, or...
Yeah, I know there are a couple of unanswered questions in the Q&A, but I mean, just to be mindful of time, I'd just like to thank everyone. Matt, of course, and Sophie and all the speakers for joining us, and everybody else who's stuck around at the different hours of the day. I know some people are about to go to bed. Some are just waking up and some are going to happy hour. So thanks again for participating.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much as well. Yeah, been great to do this. I look forward to our next session, and hopefully we can plan that over the coming months. So again, thanks to Nicole and ITRC and all of the speakers for their time today. Look forward to seeing many people at our upcoming conference as well, between the 10th and 13th of October in Melbourne, Australia. If you're not going to be there, then hopefully you can grab the presentations that will be presented over the course of that event. So thanks again from myself. We'll hand back to Devin.
Well, that will do it for us. Thank you. I just want to say thank you to everybody for joining, and a special thank you to all of our panelists for taking the time to be with us here today. I did put the link for the feedback form in the chat for everybody. That's going to be how you receive a certificate of completion if you are interested in one. And then I put it in the chat earlier, but again, if you would like any clarification on any questions or have any further questions you would like answered, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will coordinate getting those questions answered for our audience here. I'll put that email in the chat here real quick, but otherwise, I hope everybody has a wonderful rest of their day. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to see you on a future training session.